We've got a man here this morning who does not know the meaning of the word no. He is a just say yes man. Goodness me, co-founder of Apple, left in 1985, could sit back and relax and just watch hockey. But no, a serial entrepreneur, a serial philanthropist, a person who really want to keep that drive, that infectious energy, that contribution to education. You know who I'm talking about, someone who we hope is going to provide us with some thoughts and some answers to the sorts of questions we've got in our mind about where the next steps in effective innovation are. Please welcome to the platform. In fact, give a huge EBN 22nd Congress welcome to the wizard that was. Please welcome Steve Wozniak.
Thank you. That was the best introduction I ever had, that song. If you knew the purpose of meaning and little words and stories and messages in my life, you know, and even Steve Jobs and I talked about that before Apple. Going way back, you know, technology, I come from technology background, not political, not businessman, and, you know, not financial. But when I was young, my dad, an engineer, taught me that, well, what engineers do, they create the great things that help us with our life. They create things like washing machines and described how our great-grandparents had to wash clothes by hand. And I thought, oh, how awful it is, you know. And if you measure life by happiness, they probably were as happy as we are. But I thought, wow, we're the ones who make life so nice. And we make extra time for people so that they can have more leisure time and maybe someday only work 4 days a week instead of five. And looking back 20 years later, here we are in Silicon Valley, it takes two people working full-time, stressful jobs just to own a home. So we were successful in all our creations of this computer technology. And the computer technology, of course, gives us more in life, but it also enables us to use more energy per person. Develop a computer, now somebody can do a job easier, but for some reason we don't start working easier, we just do more work. We find other ways to use more of it. So it might actually be that a lot of the pollution that we have is partly due to computers. It's kind of a funny paradox. And when I grew up also, you know, it was like, okay, you'd have devices that saved you work, like cars. They did the work of tons of people, you know, and you'd have devices that saved you thinking. I mean, we didn't have calculators yet in those days, but also we'd have greater entertainment. When I was young, what was it? It was radio and television, and those hadn't existed in the past. Wow, how did people ever get by without these great things? But always, very often when you introduce something good, a lot of society likes to look at it and say, it's changed, it's different, so there must be something bad about it. Television must be bad, we're watching television rather than getting education, and we're listening to music when we should be reading books, and that sort of stuff. And that'll always happen with every new change. I like to sometimes say that change is the new norm. Change is the new status quo. It's really funny, but you think now we've got devices that do so much for us, like calculators. Why do we ever have to do as much calculation in our head? Why do we have to be able to know how to multiply in our heads anymore? So a lot of people kind of lose a lot of the fundamental skills. That's okay. And the reason it's okay is we're taught a lot of things in school, and we're told this is what a complete educated life is about. You learn all these subjects. Well, you know what? When you finally wind up actually working and creating things for society, you're pretty narrow. You're in one field. And yes, you might be in a field that has to use a lot of mathematics, a lot of science, a lot of physics. You might be in another field that doesn't. We don't need everybody in society to be a mathematical genius, you know, and be able to do differential calculations and solve circuits. So we don't have to teach everything to everyone. That's one mistake that we make with schools. I'm going to talk about education a little later. Even though it's hard to say where we get with all this technology, we don't make ourselves happier, we smile the same, we frown the same as we did ages ago, but we have some inner urge that we're born with to be curious, to explore, to see how the universe is made and what we can make different. What can we make? We've got this drive, and we wouldn't have the drive in us unless it were the right thing to do that's going to eventually get us to that, you know, that Eudora, that perfect world. It's sort of our meaning in life is to follow the urges that we're born with. I belonged to a club in the early days that inspired me. I had a lot of skills. I'm not going to describe all those. But in this club called the Homebrew Computer Club, the first club in the world to use the word computer, we had a bunch of intellectuals that came from universities like Stanford and the University of California at Berkeley, and they would speak to us kind of like futurists, but based on reality and real technology. They were technologists as well as intellectuals, and they would talk to us about how someday, when everyone had computers of their own, the world was going to change. Okay, communication. Our view of how greatly the world was going to change was that somebody was going to be able to type a message. They wanted to communicate to another group of people with similar interests. They would type a message, it would go over a modem and get stored on a computer. And over the next hour, 100 people could dial in one at a time to that computer and read the message. You could get a message to 100 people. That was a dream that was amazing. It was such a dream. I was so shy in those days, I would never raise my hand, never engage in the conversations, sat in the back row of 550 of us, just listening and listening, the most important day of my life, every 2 weeks, to hear what these people were talking about technology and how we could help others and how we could provide technological parts and what we needed to get things built. And I listened to this kind of talk, and I thought, this is so amazing what we're going to do to the world. A social revolution in education. Children go home, they do homework, and they would go back to school and find out if their answer was right or wrong the next day. But if you study psychology, reward and punishment is only effective if it's immediate. Now with a computer, you were going to be able to type the answer to a question and be told immediately if it was right or wrong. Learning was going to be so dramatic. Someone in our club spoke about how children were to use 100% of their brain instead of 10%. And I was getting scared in the audience, thinking that within a few years, all these kids were going to be a lot smarter than us adults. So that one didn't turn out yet, but someday it may. We were also going to be able to control things in our lives, like, you know, garage doors and windows and temperatures, thermostats. We were going to be able to control them with this device called a computer. And that's like when you have remote control, you're a Superman. You can push one tiny button and cause a major impact to happen. And that's exciting stuff. But probably the most important thing of all to me was that those little guys of ourselves, shy guys maybe, a lot of us, and we didn't ever, none of us were wealthy, none of us were executives in companies, we all had computer skills. We all wanted to own our own computer. I told my father back in high school, someday I'm going to own my own computer instead of a house. And because he said it costs as much as a house. So here we were in this club, and it was exciting, but we technical people, with our little mastery of these devices, we're going to have affordable computers. We were going to take them into the places where we work, the million-dollar companies with the million-dollar computers, and we were going to be calculating what the company should do with its finances quicker than their own computers would, and better, because the programs would be written by our 10-year-old kids. What an exciting dream that was. These were all dreams. But they were really possibly real. Now, when I started out in electronics, I was lucky to grow up in Silicon Valley. Got to see a lot of changes firsthand. Every place in the world right now, there's usually, not every place, but there's centers in most countries that want to find the way to this information technology of the future, and they want to be the next Silicon Valley. And we often hear, well, that's not even the way to look, and there's actually a lot of very close to Silicon Valleys in the United States, different cities where close to that many people work in technology. We've been so successful, we attracted the people of the world that love technology, science, mathematics, that sort of stuff. So Silicon Valley is one of only 10 counties in the United States where now more than half the people speak non-English at home. That's been the influx of people to be a part of it. But when I was very young, I went to a show about 8 years old, and I saw a man, it might have been Gordon Moore, one of the people that got a Nobel Prize for inventing the chip, show a photograph with a bunch of little blocks on it saying, this is going to be a chip. We're going to make one piece of silicon that has 6 transistors on it, all connected. And wow, that was exciting to hear. The most valuable possession of my life was a little 6-transistor radio that I could tune in music and listen to music all night long while I slept. I'd leave the radio on every night. It was the gadget of my life. And I went to my dad and I said, now we're going to have better transistor radios, right, with these chips. And he said, well, no, Steve, it doesn't work that way. New technologies like chips are so expensive. Nobody could afford them. A device that has about the smarts of a wall switch would cost hundreds of today's dollars. And I said, darn it. He said, only the military can afford it because they're launching missiles. We had a space race going on, and you have to save every little fraction of a gram you can, and that's why chips were important to the military before they were low enough cost for us. And he said that what we average Joes in our own homes use, well, we get what falls off. The excess parts, the surplus, the older stuff, that's what we get into our own lives. Darn it, I wanted to make lives better. I felt so darn. But you know what? It's really funny because in my lifetime, it's reversed. Now, the greatest, most powerful chips are designed for personal computers and for game machines. And because of their high volume of things like NAND flash chips that are in every smartphone and every starting with the iPod, the prices came down so far. Now the military uses those devices and takes advantage of the prices that are due to normal consumer needs. So anyway, I wanted to help this social revolution happen. People changing their life in education, communication, and the technical guy being important. And so my approach was I will build the computer, which I had a lot of pieces at my hand. I'd sort of built up to that stage. I'll build a computer, and I gave it away for free. And, you know, I gave out the design. No copyright notices. I said, build your own. I wanted everyone to build their own that was going to help start this revolution of social norms. And it was then that Steve Jobs came by and actually saw it. And I was telling him what it was all about. And he said, we should start a company. But I'm going to get into that just a little bit later. He didn't say to start a computer company either. So, you know, it's really funny, but if we look at technology, almost everything we do in our lives now, you can think of what you pull out, some computer program to communicate with people, a cell phone, little apps that you run that help you get things done, to everything from getting taxi, ordering pizza, finding out where movies are, everything in life, and you have that computer with you all day long when it's in your pocket. So life has really changed more than anything else because of the technology. We couldn't foresee it, but the guy who showed me that little picture of the first chip, Gordon Moore it might have been, Moore's Law, based on him. Moore's Law and the scalar process of forming chips out of photographs and reducing the size of the photographs and reducing the size of things, higher and higher resolution is what led to a chip being for the same price today, we can make 1 billion transistors as we can make one transistor. That's what's happened because of Moore's Law. So, of course, society's changed a lot. Will Moore's Law end? We might be getting close to the end of it. People fear, when does Moore's Law end and we stop having more and more and more every year? And already we're down to the point where most of the memory chips of the world, the NAND flash chips, are storing ones and zeros with just like 10 electrons. It's getting down close to the limit of what you can actually reliably do and repeat every time. When we look at technologists of all time, famous ones like Thomas Edison, you know, and Benjamin Franklin and ones before that, and look at the devices they played with, it was in people's lives, it was things like audio recording, it was telephones, it was movies, and it was lighting in homes, and it was electrical power. Funny thing is, we're still applying today's modern technology and chip technology to all of those areas, but there's one new element that never existed back in those years when those inventors were busy. They didn't have a computer, the ability to apply computing to their tasks. So computer really has changed life a lot, and that's why change seems faster now than it probably ever was in history. I don't know if that's true, but it feels like it. Maybe it feels like it for every single generation. It's hard to say. Who starts the new companies that really change things a lot? Companies like Apple, Yahoo, Google, Facebook. It's generally young people, you know, in college, just out of college. Why? They don't have attachments to cranking over the money chain and keeping things going the way they've been going like all the big companies do. When we started with personal computers, the big computer company said, little machines based on little chips called microprocessors, they were never going to be able to do the real big tasks. And the funny time came when all of a sudden we had what was called a spreadsheet for doing financial calculations on a TV screen, being able to make changes to income and expenses in January, see instantly the results in December. Now we had a machine that was small, carryable like a typewriter, that could do more than the big mainframes. So anyway, I'm getting back to Why do young people do that? Well, they aren't attached to the way it's been done before is what you keep doing in life. It's like, I got an idea that I would like, and it's never been done, and nobody can necessarily appreciate it. A lot of people can say it's not going to go anywhere, like the big computer companies that said these personal computers are going to be just a little technical hobby, you know, for people who know how to hold soldering irons and hook things together. Young people, first of all, have a lack of money. That means they've got to come up with solutions that are low cost. And that's very important to starting a new business. You can always dream up an idea and build it if you got millions of dollars. Lots of people love to talk about how, oh, in their company they research this, or in their university they research this stuff. Yeah, a huge influx of money can let you do that kind of research. But the young people that really want to do things with no money at all have to think and think and think and come up with the clever approaches to save. Also, since the young people are generally not connected to a big company, to the status quo, how things are made, they're willing to go off and try new things that might just be for fun. They don't have to be for value. They don't have a lot of money in their lives. They're often very shy, like I was, and they do a lot of internal thinking to themselves. They're independent thinkers. They don't have to have everyone else going in the direction they're going. They don't have to do things by the standard rules. That means they're young people are much greater risk takers. Once you have a big success in your life, success will sometimes change you, and you want to now only pursue greater success, more money, more wealth, more power. Those become your goals, but they aren't the goals when you start and you're young. Now, when the young people get going at something, they're usually going off in such a new direction. You know, I'm talking about things like Google or Facebook or even Apple. Going off in a new direction, something that hasn't been done before. It's not like you're doing the same thing a different way. It's like you're doing something that's just like so different and out of the book. You're really writing the book. The difference between that, when you go to school, you read a lot of books and you get information. It's called knowledge. It's called intelligence. And you're judged by scores of how much you can remember. But that isn't really thinking. And we all acknowledge it's not thinking. But if you go off and you start working on something very different, your own ideas, your approaches, without having read the book on how people make a certain kind of product, you invent it yourself if you're smart enough and you know the building blocks. I call these building blocks the atoms, the little parts, the components you can buy. It's almost like the blocks of lumber you could buy to build a building. But if you build it yourself, and it's for your own reasons, you find solutions that other people wouldn't find. There's a lot of people that are called hackers. There's groups set up called hacker spaces that supply a lot of soldering irons and wires and tools and 3D printers and the sorts of devices that young people with an interest can use and make it available at a very low cost. And these are the do-it-yourselfers you hear about it, the builders that build things themselves. I had a whole life where I had built one huge project after another, after another, another, and that helps to be the builder. It helps to cross the disciplines of not only coming up with an idea, having the knowledge of how to design it, or just playing around and figuring out and teaching yourself, as I said, writing the book on how to build it, and then being able to actually be the builder and nail, whether it's nailing things together or soldering parts together. Motivation. There's extrinsic rewards and there's intrinsic rewards. And the extrinsic rewards are the ones everyone in the world can see. They can see how much money you get, what your salary is. They can see your title, your awards, your position in a company. And, you know, those are visible rewards. But then there's inside rewards, that your own head is doing what it wants to do, what it would do if nobody was paying you. And those are the most important motivating factors we have. So the intrinsic, when you're doing something for yourself that doesn't necessarily have a business goal, or you're not even sure it's going to really make a lot of money or something, it still can be the highest motivator and the highest drive there is. One time, I realized that if I could somehow, we started out with our company with the Apple II computer that had storage on cassette tapes, because cassette tapes were free. Everyone had a cassette tape player. It was just like everyone had a television, so it was essentially free. I had to work in that style back in those days with absolutely no money. But we were in a meeting, and they were going to let Apple Computer into a show in Las Vegas, Nevada, the City of Lights. Oh, I would have loved to go. We were only sending three sales guys, our marketing guy, Mike Markula, our sales guy, Gene Carter, and Steve Jobs. And, oh, my gosh, engineers are tricky. I would never dare, I'd be too scared to raise my hand and say, can I go, because I want you to spend money so I can see Las Vegas. So I raised my hand and I said, if we have a floppy disk, can we show it? Now, I had never worked on a disk drive of any type in my life, I had never worked with a disk operating system in my life. It was foreign to me. But now, if I got a floppy disk developed in 2 weeks, I got to go to Las Vegas, Nevada. And all I had to be able to do was write run checkbook, and it runs the checkbook program. Run color math, then it runs the flashcard program. That's all I needed to do. And man, I sat down not knowing how to design these things, taking the parts that were available, thinking out what I'm writing is signals onto a magnetic structure, and then the signal comes back, skipping all these chips they had in the way and disk languages they had in the whole, get rid of as many parts as I can, because it was my forte of design, figuring out, since I have a computer, I can actually program the computer to do part of the work, and vice versa, and wound up with this tiny little board that did a disk drive, and it worked, and I got to go to Las Vegas. That intrinsic reward of, I don't know, getting to see Las Vegas, it's a personal matter. Whenever anyone has a personal reason for getting something done to prove themselves, that's when the work gets done. I work every day and night over Christmas vacation, over New Year's Day, just kept working to get that floppy disk done in time. And the funny thing is, that kind of work that you do, you force yourself, when it's for yourself, to show off, to look, to be proud of, that you did something clever. When you're working on it, and even if you've never done it before and yet you haven't been taught out of a book how to do it, or your design might be 50 chips instead of 6 chips, when you do that, it's so motivating. You do the most incredible job. You think out every way to make things small, to make them clever, to make you look good. The product that you're designing becomes an extension of yourself. It's how you are viewed. It's how your product is viewed. And that's where the best designs come from. It's when you have a personal motivation attached to it. Companies, you know, often have a product culture. They're going along with, here's the sort of products we make, here's how they work, here's how we have to keep extending them. I worked at Hewlett-Packard designing the hot iPhone 5 of its day. It was the Hewlett-Packard handheld scientific calculator. It would revolutionize engineering and science. Within a few years, every scientist and engineer had to buy this expensive calculator instead of a cheap slide rule, and the slide rule companies went out of business. It was that disruptive. Well, at Hewlett-Packard, we were the first, and we had this language of our calculator called reverse Polish notation. It's weird. You would type one number, save it, and then you'd type another number without seeing the first one anymore, and then you'd say plus, and it added the two and put it in the display. A strange system, but we computer scientists know what it's all about, because we have to take the normal mathematics expressions that you're taught in school with parentheses to order when things are done, and we have to convert it into reverse Polish notation to execute it on a computer anyway. So the Hewlett-Packard calculators just work that way. Texas Instruments came out with a calculator working the way we write equations with parentheses. So we laughed. We said, it's a toy. It has parentheses. Young children are taught to use parentheses. It can't do the big equations. So I took our big equation example. I thought I was the smartest one, and I thought I'd type it in, and I start out, okay, the first part of this equation to get solved is that part right there. So I'm going to type in about 5 parentheses, 6, 7. And then I realized I'm never going to remember how many parentheses levels I'm in or out. No human could have that good of a memory to solve this huge, huge equation that took minutes to solve. Cleared my mind, like Socrates says. Sometimes clear your mind, start over. This is just like I did on the floppy disk. Without having a mindset of how they're made, you can make a better one. Clear your mind, and I said, oh my gosh, this calculator has to be able to solve it. What's the method? The method was simple. Type the equation in from left to right. As fast as I could, I did it and got the right answer the first time. The other engineers at Hewlett-Packard couldn't believe me. You know, they couldn't believe it. I handed them the calculator. I said, type it in from left to right. Every parenthesis you see, just type it. Not one of them could do it. They all were in a mindset of you have to use your mind to think out how to solve the equation. Something comes along that's easier and you don't have to use your mind. Your skill, you denigrate it. You give it less respect. You don't think it's capable of doing the full job. It's actually just making life a little easier, and it's saying that the same language that we write equations is on a calculator. So it was right in another sense, too. It's just that why didn't the Hewlett-Packard calculators do it that way? Because they came out so early, we could only get 1,000 transistors on a chip, and it took 3 chips just to hold the program that made the calculator work. We couldn't afford the programming to figure out, convert the parentheses down to this reverse Polish stuff. That's really the reason. And now Hewlett-Packard was stuck with its original starting point when a better method had come along. They couldn't switch to it.